The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program is an exploration of the root causes of civil disorders in our nation's cities and is the first in a series of four discussions entitled A Country in Crisis. Our guests today are Dr. June Jackson Christmas, psychiatrist and director of the Harlem Rehabilitation Center, New York City, and Rabbi Wolf Kelman, visiting professor of homiletics at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America and executive vice president of the Rabbinical Assembly, the International Organization of Conservative Rabbis. Moderator for the series is Mr. Charles E. Silberman, member of the board of editors of Fortune Magazine, director of the Carnegie Study of the Education of Educators, and author of The Myths of Automation and Crisis in Black and White. Mr. Silberman.
This is the first of a four-part discussion series on a country in crisis, the country being the United States. It seems to me that the real crisis in the United States is that essentially decent people still think that the crisis is that of civil disorders and not that of the injustices, the racial injustices, which lie behind the civil disorders. Do you have any response to that, Wolf?
Two responses. I know that when the rioting and the looting took place immediately after Dr. King's assassination, some of my friends and colleagues expressed their dismay and their shock at some of the incidents and disorders were taking place. And I asked them whether they had expressed equal dismay and shock when there was greater disorder and greater injustice perpetrated against the black people in the South and in the North in years past. It was only someone who had been concerned about the disorders then who I felt had a moral prerogative, a patent to speak on disorders today. The second reaction I have is that we tend to focus so much on the disorders and on those that are properly leading and articulating the sense of injustice, which they had not done before, that we tend to overlook those aspects in our society which tend towards justice, which tend towards rectifying the injustices that have been perpetrated in the past. We should try to keep some balance without overlooking the great, terrible guilt we all bear for the injustice.
Well, how do you feel about this balance?
Well, I think it's very hard as a black person to keep this kind of balance because although I am one of the few black people who can say that I've had a relatively fortunate life, I too have experienced the same kinds of prejudice and discrimination and suffering from being considered not human that many millions of my black brothers face today. So that balance is hard for me because I've had it hard and many, many people have had it much harder. Actually, I see the crisis in even broader terms than this. I think that the crisis is one of our whole American society at a point where we may wonder if there's any chance for real representational government ever to exist. I feel that the kind of violence that you spoke of, Rabbi Kelman, that has been perpetrated on people of color, particularly black Americans and Indian Americans for hundreds of years, may be repaid with attempts at insurgency and violence by black people. And of course, if that happens, because numerically we're so few, there are going to be greater repressive measures taken not only against the black people who do this, but against people who are sympathetic, you and others who support us, so that I fear for the way this country is going. And yet I know that emotionally I have to support every effort, whether it's an activist effort or a discussion like this or an attempt to communicate across racial lines.
Do you see the violence as a kind of temporary phenomenon that will peter out, or do you see it as perhaps a longer-term phenomenon? We had a feeling a few years back that the release of the anger which was beginning, would be cathartic, so to speak. And once the anger got expressed, we could begin to focus on where we went from here. Now, some of us sympathetic whites begin to wonder, for the moment at least, the anger appears to be cumulative rather than cathartic. The more anger that gets expressed, the more anger there is to express. How, as a psychiatrist, as well as someone who's black, do you see any possibilities of that anger being channeled in ways that can reconstruct the society rather than just tear it down?
I know that as long as there's been violence perpetrated against black people have harbored anger and hatred against white people, but they've done a relatively fair job of either hiding it or changing it into maybe slowing down on the job or giving the answer that was expected and in another way working against the person in control, the master. And I think the other damaging way that anger has been handled in the past has been turning it against oneself. And we all know the high rate of in-group violence that goes on in black communities.
Well, wasn't now, there a third alternative?
What are you thinking of?
To take this hostility and anger into a form of what the real ideological founder of the Zionist movement, who was a physician, by the way,
yes,
Dr. Leon Pinsker,
yeah,
who wrote a book called Otto Emancipation, where there was this pent-up anger of the Jew in the ghetto in Russia, some of whom expressed it in a variety of ways, some in revolution, some by becoming leading revolutionaries, some in turning against themselves. But then there was also the group who became the forerunners of the Zionist movement, who stressed Otto Emancipation.
Well, I think this is the stage we're at now, and I see there are two trends going on. One is the sporadic outburst of, at first unorganized and now later organized, a destruction of property. Property that symbolizes white power, white economic power. And the second, I think, is in this trend towards black consciousness and black identity. And I think that although in the long run, most black people in this country probably want some degree of integration, we may have to go through these stages where black identity and auto-emancipation are the result of constructive use of anger. And I think we're in both of those stages now. How much is going to be this sporadic and mounting destructive use of anger, and how much can be turned to a creative kind of change? I don't know.
One of the things that does confuse and unsettle a great many people is the whole upsurge of black nationalism, separatism, which has kind of reversed the rules of the game in many respects. And there is some real confusion. How do we relate to the whole struggle for racial justice? What should we do? Should we simply sit back on the sidelines? Should we try to help? Or will we get clobbered side or the other in the struggle going on within the black community if we do try to help?
I think you can help. And you know where I think your help should be directed? Not in giving assistance, except perhaps, say, moral support in that way to the black people in the struggle, but directed against the people that are the cause of it all. You can help by speaking to white people. I feel this very strongly. I think that the one area in the Kerner report that I felt was not covered adequately was strategies for changing white people's behaviors. And maybe in the long run changing their attitudes, but at least changing their behaviors. And my feeling is that the major effort of white people who seriously see themselves as suffering from this kind of discrimination, racism, whatever it is that they work with other white people to change behaviors, beginning with, as you are working, say, in school boards, working in one's own professional organizations, working in housing, working in legislation, but really making white people see two things. One, that they have a stake, that they're going to lose something ultimately if things don't change, and that to some degree they are all responsible.
Now, millions of white listeners and perhaps some black listeners are listening to this program. What would you tell a rabbi or anyone else who reaches the listeners of this program to tell him about racism. Not merely the question of they may or may not lose something.
Well, I think, first of all, if we think of what it means for a white child to grow up thinking that he is superior simply by virtue of being white, if we could think of the damaging effect that this has upon him in the long run, it may not be so easy to see, because most people who think they're better than other people walk around behaving as though they are, and they don't think they've lost anything. But I think if we can point out to them that this kind of misperception really deprives them and their children, for example, from knowing the richness of many other cultures and many other people. It deprives them of the chance from playing, loving, hating as individuals, people who cannot possibly live in their apartment house or in their community in Scarsdale or Mount Vernon or Central Park West. And I'm speaking of buildings and places where I know the housing issue has been fought. It's been a struggle for people in the three particular areas that I mentioning to see that they were fighting, and these are white people, not only to get a black family in there, but so that they would have a better stake in this country. So that one of the things I would do is address people on the things that count the most, their families, their jobs, their children, in terms of their own personal investment. And then I would really say that a rabbi or anyone else who influences people might see where those people who have power, you know, either their employers, they're PTA people. They are in any position of influencing others. In other words, address ourselves to people whomever we come in contact with and say, what can you do to change this country so that it'll continue to exist but in a better way? I think, as Wolf said a little earlier, that there are all kinds of variations of racism. But when I think of American white racism, I think of the fact that although a few black people came here with Columbus, with Spanish explorers, the bulk of black people, and they were free, of course, the bulk of black people came as slaves, brought here as slaves, and treated as American, on USA-type American slaves. And I point this out because I think there's quite a difference between the way Americans, white Americans, regarded black people, both in the times of slavery and now, and the way black people have been regarded in other countries. I think that this influences...
You think American racism is more virulent than the racism that you find is almost universal phenomenon?
I'm not sure you do.
A form of xenophobia?
Well, I think this question of fearing people who are different from you, it does exist in many, many people. There is no question of that. But I think that institutionalized ways of treating groups of people as different because of color has become part of American life. And I contrast this, say, with Latin American countries, where you have large numbers of black and Indian people, but to some degree, there is more mobility among them. In other words, once they are able to move to the point of having any kind of education or move to a higher social class, race is not the thing that's held against them. And I think this comes back from the historical part of slavery. Here in America, slaves were things. There was no possible way that any black man or woman as a slave generally could buy his freedom. We know of exceptional instances where people did, but it wasn't so. They were things, not human beings.
Yeah, don't you deal with that?
Yes, I did. I did deal with this in some length in my book, Christ in Black and White. The drawing very heavily on work by Professor Stanley Elkins, Professor Frank Tannenbaum. The basic distinction here, interestingly, is that in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies, the continuation of feudalism meant that there had been a perpetuation from Roman times of a tradition of slavery. And in antiquity, as we know from the study of our own Bible, slavery didn't carry any racial stigma. It was a misfortune of economic life. It was a misfortune of war. One moved into slavery out of slavery without any permanent stigma. And so in a feudal society, there were a whole series of gradations ranging from slave to serf to free man. Moreover, the Catholic Church interposed itself between the state and the citizenry. It had a responsibility for the souls of everyone, slave or free. Therefore, it insisted on all marriages, slave marriages,
right,
as well as free marriages, being part of the sacrament of the church. The English colonies had a quite different problem. And England was, at the time the New World was settled, a society of free men. Therefore, they had a terrible problem. How do you accommodate slavery in a society which is presumed to be based on a contract among free men?
Mm-hmm.
And the solution was essentially to appeal to the inferiority of the slave, that if you could demonstrate that the slave was incapable of freedom, it wasn't simply an economic convenience to have him as a slave, it was a positive service to him. And the way it was handled legally was to apply the laws governing chattel, movable property, to slaves.
So
that
the slave
became a thing. And this has, I think, pervaded our sense of Negro-white relations. I think this has much to do, not simply the generalized xenophobia, but this whole background has much to do with this enormous upsurge of racist sentiment in Great Britain in the past several years, as the black population has increased. But Wolf, you seem to express some reservations about this characterizing of white racism as a general cause of the whole problem. Did I understand you correctly?
As someone trained in the rabbinic tradition to avoid generalizations of all kinds.
Including that one.
Especially including about avoiding generalizations, yes. I'm always uncomfortable when I hear statements like white racism or Negro anti-Semitism or American imperialism, because one has to draw subtle distinctions and nuances. And I think one can fairly, and I must say that in this respect, your book has been my guide and teacher as far as slavery is concerned. And it led me to try to analyze that there is a difference between the way, for example, that the Jewish tradition has informed even the contemporary Jew in his relationship to racism, to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
As you already mentioned, in the Jewish Bible, slavery was not a disgrace. There were Jewish slaves, there were slaves of other nations, and there were carefully regulated the rules on how one had to treat a slave and the punishments involved in mistreating the slave within the terms of those rules. I think in the Catholic tradition you've had what Mr. Fulman has already referred to, and the same is true in the Protestant tradition, which developed in a different way. And to speak of white racism, I think is also a generalization, because there's a racism which leads to physical violence and lynching. There's a racism with which we may all be permeated, a slight discomfort with those whom we don't know that may be overcome when you get to know the person who is different. And there are all the shades in between. So I think in this kind of discussion of all the people involved, one has to make these distinctions.
But are they a distinction without a difference?
I think that when Wolf speaks of, say, a discomfort and being with people whom one does not know, I think that this is a kind of, it's sort of extreme to label this as racism, I would feel, unless, of course, we think that one of the reasons that one does not know this person is that one has been brought up to think of this person as a non-person. And there you find the link between behavior, where people, for example, think often of how when I'm walking along Central Park West and I see white parents at the school where my children go, on Central Park West, where they live, people recognize me, you know, hello, Jew, you know, we talk about school. When I'm on Columbus Avenue, which until recently was a street of tenements with a lot of Latin American and other black people, Negroes, I passed people, and I would open my mouth as if to say hello, and I was lost, apparently, in the sea of other black faces. I became a nothing because I was in an area where perhaps they were not tuned to look at individual people, or perhaps their anxieties were so great they just didn't want to see people. But I became a thing or a non-thing. Now, if I call it racism, I suppose, in a way, I'm speaking the truth, and yet I feel it's a kind of a result of being carefully schooled in being comfortable in knowing only those people that one is close to or the feelings of like one.
I'm concerned, though, at a somewhat different level. And what I see happening in my own community and a great many other communities, mine is simply 5 or 10 or 15 years ahead of the rest of the country, Mount Vernon, New York, is that these important differences in attitudes on race begin to disappear somewhat under the pressures of actual physical confrontation of black and white. As the Negro move to the suburb, changes a predominantly white middle-class suburb into a real microcosm of the rest of the country, what we find happening is not that the liberals all disappear. The differences are important. What white liberal leadership exists in my community is almost entirely Jewish. But what we do find is that a painfully large proportion of the Jewish community is beginning to behave pretty much the same way as the majority of the rest of the white community, which is to say either to flee to other locations or to vote for, in the case of school board elections, for staunch advocates of the neighborhood school. And so what I see happening, and it pains me terribly, is that our tradition seems to be becoming somewhat less operative rather than more operative under the actual confrontation with all of the tensions and conflicts that arise. There are fears that are real, that are substantive. There are fears that have no real basis. And this is, I think, what we have to begin to deal with. And it seems to me that when the Kerner Commission is talking about white racism in this broad generalization, it's this kind of phenomenon, that at some level the differences seem to melt away too much. Now,
certainly it's been true that many Negroes who had worked, to say, in the civil rights movement along with white people, many of whom were Jews, are in the South, for example, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, are now saying when the struggle comes to a Mount Vernon or to closer to home, to Boston or the suburbs of, you know, Brookline, that their Jews are behaving like all the rest of the white people. And I think you wonder sometimes whether black people hadn't assumed that out of a history of oppression that Jews would be more closely identified with them, as I think sometimes they were. But they had also felt that Jews would be different from the rest of white people. And I'm not sure that in this country that white people are free to be that different from the pervading mores of this country.
Well,
I hope they will. I hope.
I respectfully disagree, because I think there is a world of difference.
Well,
Without attributing all virtue to one group and all vice to another, there's a world of difference between the attitude in one community where the struggle is against having white policemen shoot black people on sight without too much public condemnation, and the real fleeing of a Jew from a suburb that's about to integrate, which is also bad.
Well, you see, I think they're both evidences of accepting this racism. Fortunately, I think they're different too, qualitatively. I think they're different.
I think we as Jews, Wolf, are really now struggling with many of these questions. In what respect are we different? In what respect are we the same? We, in a sense, were anxious to prove for many years that we were no different from anyone else in the United States. Perhaps we proved the case a little too strongly. Now we are concerned really with establishing through those parts of our tradition we want to maintain that the differences are real. And I think we're finding that we perhaps succeeded too well, that while there are differences in some areas, and this is one, the differences are not as large any longer as we would like to believe. Let me try to bring this program to a close, then, just reading one or two more sentences from the Kerner Commission report. This is our basic conclusion, the report states. Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Reaction to last summer's disorders has quickened the movement and deepened the division. This deepening racial division is not inevitable. The movement apart can be reversed. Choice is still possible. Our principal task is to define that choice and to press for a national resolution. In the next 3 weeks, we will be discussing the ways in which that choice can be exercised, the ways in which we can reverse this movement to two separate and unequal societies.
Our Eternal Light program today was the first in a series of four entitled A Country in Crisis. We have tried to get at the root causes of what's happening in our cities. On subsequent programs, we will deal with what can be done to ameliorate the situation locally, nationally, and through religion. Participating in today's discussion were Dr. June Jackson Christmas, psychiatrist and director of the Harlem Rehabilitation Center, New York City, and Rabbi Wolf Kelman, visiting professor of homiletics at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America and executive vice president of the Rabbinical Assembly, the International Organization of Conservative Rabbis. Moderator for the series is Mr. Charles E. Silberman, an editor of Fortune magazine and author of Crisis in Black and White. If you would like a copy of today's program, please send your name and address with 25 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York, New York, 10027. We invite you to join us next week when the Eternal Light will present the second discussion in this series. Our guests will be Mr. William Booth, chairman of the New York City Commission on Human Rights, and Rabbi Seymour Siegel, associate professor of theology at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is Bill Wendell speaking. The Eternal Light is produced for NBC by Rhoda Grady. This program was directed by Jeff Culliver. Harold Flender is editorial consultant for this series. For the seminary, Dr. Ben Zion Boxer of the Forest Hills Jewish Center is program editor, Milton E. Krentz, producer, and Nancy Waltman, program coordinator. The Eternal Light is presented weekly under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Mental Health Association is helping the patient every step of the way. Support your Mental Health Association.
This is Joe Garagiola. For a weekend look at what's new in the sports world, join me every Saturday and Sunday on Monitor on NBC Radio.